Live on digital radio, colorfulradio.com and apps. This is Colorful Radio.
Long-awaited transgender guidance for schools in England is expected to be published by the government later after being delayed from the summer. The report suggests the non-statutory guidance will require schools to inform parents if their children say they wish to change their gender identity. Britain is set to join an international coalition to protect ships sailing through the Red Sea after tankers came under attack from militants in Yemen. The announcement comes after oil giant BP paused all of its tanker journeys over safety concerns. A think tank has warned urgent reforms are needed to slow the decay of NHS dentistry. A report by Nuffield Trust claims it's at its most perilous point in its 75-year history. After his death on the 30th of November, the funeral of Alistair Darling takes place in Edinburgh today. Carl Pike, who worked for the Labour Party, tells us what sort of a man he was.
And he was completely lovely and just a really nice person to be around, even in the midst, as it was then, of all of this turmoil.
And that's the latest. From Radio News Hub, I'm Paul Blundell.
Tonight's Euro Millions jackpot is £186 million.
Now that calls for a dance, Dermot. How about a salsa?
How about a two-step?
Woo! Somebody's got moves.
It's all in the hips, my friend. Woo! Get that Euro Millions feeling tonight. Euro Millions from the National Lottery. Play on app. Estimated jackpot. Account terms, rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
Coming up, Africa in Focus. Africa in Focus.
Hello?
Baby, hey, I'm still outdoors.
Gotcha. Leave your name and your number, and I'll get back to you as soon as possible.
Why do I always forget about your stupid voicemail? Anyway, I'm out shopping still. The weather's really bad, like, so be careful. Text me.
The weather outside is frightful, but the fire so delightful. And since we've no place to go, let it snow.
Good morning, good afternoon, or even good evening, depending on the time zone that you're listening to us from, or you're connecting to us from. Welcome to Africa in Focus. I'm your host, Julius Baluto. And we're coming to you, of course, all the way from the heart of London, to the comfort of your sitting rooms or cars, wherever you are, from the heart of London, on Colorful Radio, to wherever you are. So join us. In today's show, I'm joined by my great friend, I always call him, he's not partner in crime, he's a partner is, you know, a search for democracy, search for good things for everyone. Search for the goodies to all mankind. And he's none other than Jonas Howell, the seasoned, you know, broadcaster. He's got his own show on TV and radio.
Talk Africa, the Anglo-Indian Tunnel Sermon.
That's the one.
Logic Box as well.
Yeah, exactly. That's the one. So it's Jonas Howell. Join us, Jonas. Welcome to the show again. Is always happy to have you.
Thank you, Julius. Always a pleasure to be on the show.
Yeah, and to our listeners, of course, our focus on Africa. Yeah, we are going through that continent. We are going to touch everything, even the ones that have never been touched. We try even to reach to the tallest trees, so nothing is going to be spared. But away from that, today we want to focus on how Africa, over the years, have found itself once again disappointed or betrayed, whatever one word you want to use in the context, to put this in proper context. Of course, success of any country or of any continent depends on its leadership. So there has been these wonderful moments in Africa on the ground where you see a great leader coming to be, doing the right things that should move Africa forward. But before you know it, these leaders, they end up having either breakfast or lunch, a bullet for lunch, a bullet for breakfast, or a bullet for dinner. Not such great news. So we just want to explore that journey, hoping maybe when we look around, we may have a way out as a continent. And we'll begin our show, of course, going from where it started, and we're going to talk about a great leader, you know, who Ghana, of course, Ghana became the first African country to gain its independence from colonial rule. Of course, who else by the Brits? And then having been the first country to become independent, of course, their leader, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, was loved, you know, and he seemed to say everything that was good for Africa. But yeah, let's hear that. And this clip is courtesy to TRT World.
He survived 5 assassination attempts and was removed from power by a military coup in 1966. Kwame Nkrumah, who died in 1972, left a plethora of development, numerous publications, and an eternal legacy. Like the saying goes, Nkrumah never dies.
This decade is the decade of African independence. Forward then, to independence now. Tomorrow, the United States of Africa.
Son of a goldsmith and retail trader, born in 1909, Kwame Nkrumah attended a prestigious Catholic school called Achimota College. A good student of religion, he wanted to become a priest, but as he got older, he was intrigued by the world of politics. After graduating from Achimota, he traveled to the U.S. and attended Lincoln University in Pennsylvania in 1935. He also attained a master's degree after graduating in 1939 from Lincoln University and the University of Pennsylvania. This period was pivotal in Kwame's life. He read a lot. He was influenced by socialist literature, the works of Karl Marx, Vladimir Lenin, and Marcus Garvey. He became the president of the African Students Organization of the United States and Canada. He left the U.S. in May 1945 and went to England, where he organized the 5th Pan-African Congress in Manchester. Meanwhile, in Ghana, then a British colony known as the Gold Coast, the United Gold Coast Convention had been formed, a first-of-its-kind party working towards self-government by constitutional means. Nkrumah was invited to be the UGCC's general secretary and returned home in late 1947. Protests and riots calling for independence made Nkrumah a target for the British colonial government. He was briefly arrested in February 1948, alongside other leaders of the UGCC. A split eventually occurred in the party, and in 1949, Nkrumah formed the New Convention People's Party, committed to a program of immediate self-government. Starting in 1950, Kwame pushed for a campaign of positive action, with non-violent protests, strikes, and a boycott of British colonial authorities and business. Nkrumah was again arrested and sentenced to 1 year in prison. In February 1951, the country had its first general election. It was a done deal for the vastly popular CPP. He was elected to parliament, released from prison, and in 1952, he became the first prime minister of Ghana.
At Accra, a huge crowd cheers as Kwame Nkrumah leaves James Fort Prison, freed by the governor as an act of grace, on the eve of the inauguration of the new constitution.
Tunis, your take. I just want to shout again, Africa independence, forward, now. Independence. I
mean, independence, indeed. Every time I hear, you know, the story of Nkrumah, it just takes me back down to memory lane of hearing, you know, growing up in Ghana in primary school and being taught of Nkrumah and how Ghanaians really, really celebrated in Kwame Nkrumah. It's just as, you know, the clip you played there, he wanted to be a priest, but then realized or got involved in politics. And I think what sets Nkrumah apart, if I can start from here, and I keep saying this, is the fact that Nkrumah was a politician. Nkrumah studied politics. Nkrumah studied ideologies. He understood ideologies. In one of his books, The Conscientians, where what drove him to read Karl Marx was the fact that they were prevented from reading such books. And of course, that goes against, you know, the interest and the ideology of the US and the West by and large. So Nkrumah understood global politics. Nkrumah understood the economic challenges Africans were facing. They did not need an outsider to tell African story or to solve African problems. He realized that Africans can solve their own problems, even though at the time they were at a disadvantage due to the empire and so on and so forth. So his vision was, A, to start by gaining independence for Ghana, and then secondly, to try to also support and help and advocate for all African countries to also gain their independence. But just coming back to Ghana for a brief moment here, Nkrumah, again, as a visionary leader, he knew that for Ghana to become free, because there's no point Ghana becoming free and then other countries, surrounding countries, are still under the tutelage of the colonialists. You'll never be free. So he was dedicated and realized that something has to happen. And if I may backtrack, Ghana gained independence in 1957. And I'm not sure whether I've said this here before. Initially, it was meant to be 1947, because under the British rule, the bond which was signed by then Gold Coast and the British was that the British would rule for 100 years. So that came to an end in 1947. And that was when Nkrumah wanted Ghana to get independence in 1947. But the powers that be, the UGCC, there's a division among that political group. They actually sent for Nkrumah because Nkrumah was in London. And they bought tickets for Nkrumah to come to Ghana because they heard of Nkrumah. He was giving speeches. He was in Trafalgar Square talking about African independence, liberation, and so on and so forth. So the aristocrats, who were the UGCC, the party that was formed and invited Nkrumah to come over, they were a bit more, as some have argued, a bit more lenient and wanted their colonial masters to continue. Nkrumah was adamant. Liberation, independence must start now. And so you see the campaign. He was kicked out of the group, the political party initially, And then you saw him campaigning and so on and so forth. And then later became the first prime minister. He was actually in prison when he became the first prime minister. And that goes to show the leadership quality, a man who understood politics, a man that had a vision and knew where Ghana needed to go, and the whole of Africa. It's interesting, we're talking about betrayal right now. In the clip you just played, there was several attempts, five attempts on his life, Nkrumah's life, which some have argued that one of the attempts which happened, which I will also talk about, in the Upper Volta, which is now Burkina Faso, where a bomb was exploded. You know, when presidents, they're going to visit a place and they get met by young girls with flowers, there was actually a bomb in the flowers the girl was given to Kwame Nkrumah. The bomb detonated, but lucky or fortunately, he survived. Some have argued that the remnants of the bomb is what actually led to him getting skin cancer later on in his life. So you also, in your opening remarks there, you said, you made mention that when it seems to be an African leader who looks like he's doing the right thing, all of a sudden they're gone. So Nkrumah realized that with his vision for Ghana and by and large Africa, certain measures needs to be taken. And this is where some argue against some of his policies. And I will go into it more if you may give me the liberty to do so. Now, one thing people have said about Nkrumah, and also the moment you're seen as somebody who wants to do the right thing, of course, you gain more enemies. And no, I'm not talking about just domestic enemies, I'm talking about global enemies. And global enemies, by so I'm talking about the West, particularly the US and its associates. Nkrumah then proceeded to initiate this policy called the Preventative Detention Act, which essentially incarcerated people without being tried. And this, to many people, was Nkrumah's downfall. But some people have also argued that Nkrumah realized the attacks, many attacks on his life, realized that this needs to be put in place to stop the obstructions or people trying to stop him from doing what he needed to do for Ghana and by and large the whole continent of Africa. So to date, no one has been able to replicate or do you come anywhere near what Nkrumah did for Ghana and for Africa.
This is Colorful Radio.
Colorful Radio.
And of course, whenever today we talk about the United States of Africa, we always have to make reference to Dr. Kwame Nkrumah's speech there. Pretty much in fortnight. And there you have it. I think we are within the time that we have. We're checking on these moments of betrayal. And I think we need to talk about another one whose name is Patrice Lumumba as well, from the original Zaire, you know, the country that they used to call Zaire, but today is a country which is rich with names, from Zaire to
Congo
to Democratic Republic of Congo.
Republic of Congo, then, yes.
Yeah, so let's listen up to another, you know, clip from Congo and, you know, about Patrice Lumumba as well. We just want to capture these moments of betrayal and who was involved mainly. And this, again, clip is courtesy to TRT World.
While Belgium and the US plotted his assassination, his name was Patrice Lumumba, the first Prime Minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo. He's considered by many a martyred hero, a symbol of anti-imperialism and Pan-African unity. This is the story of how Lumumba came to power, dreaming of a better future for the Congo and Africa, and how that dream quickly turned into a nightmare as he was arrested and murdered in January of 1961, less than 7 months after independence.
La République du Congo a été proclamée.
et notre pays est maintenant entre les mains de ses propres enfants. Nous allons établir ensemble la justice sociale et assurer que les terres de notre patrie profitent véritablement à ses enfants. Voilà, sire, Excellence, Mesdames, Messieurs, mes chers compatriotes, mes frères de lutte, mes frères de race, voilà ce que j'ai voulu vous dire. Vive l'indépendance de l'unité africaine. Vive le Congo indépendant et souverain.
Patrice Lumumba there. He's speaking in French, but all he's saying is that it's time for the African land to benefit its rightful children. And he's talking again about independence of Congo, long live, and celebrating the victory of independence, and saying that there will be social justice to all. And pretty wonderful speech there in French, but there you have it. Again, I don't know whether it was a bullet for lunch or breakfast.
Well, it's interesting, Julius. Before I come on to trees, I just wanted to mention just of Kwame Nkrumah. Obviously, he was also overthrown by the powers that be, aided by the CIA, by the US. Funny enough, after the publication of his book, Neo-Colonialism, The Last Stage of Imperialism, funny enough, he was overthrown, which he exposed the ideologies and, you know, the US and so on and so forth. So it's no secret that Patrice Lumumba also shared the same vision as Nkrumah. And what happened to him? He was also betrayed by his own countryman, his fellow countryman, which seems to be the case with a lot of the African leaders post-colonial era. Yes, the reason why there's a common theme in the fight for democracy, benefiting from the land. How can you say you're free, you get independence, but the actual benefits of the land does not belong to you, or you don't get to see it, or the average person does not get to realize it? And of course, all these things were done because of the powers that be trying to protect their interests. And when I look at this, it's just, A, it saddens me. And B, I like the fact that we're actually talking about this, because I don't think a lot of the times we concentrate on betrayal. And, you know, again, so for now, I will just leave it here. Another great African leader. I will talk more about other African leaders when, you know, we get into the main point of discussion about betrayal.
Yeah, Patrice Lumumba again, another great leader gone. And of course, we have another one, extremely controversial. And this one is, we're going to listen up, courtesy to African Biographics. We're going to talk about, you know, here about Thomas Sankara of Burkina Faso.
Yeah.
In the dusty heart of Burkina Faso, where the sun sears the barren earth and the wind whispers secrets of a turbulent past, a revolutionary's voice rose, echoed and reverberated across the African plains. This revolutionary was none other than Thomas Sankara, the late former president of Burkina Faso. Sankara rose to power in 1983 and he immediately became a committed, self-sacrificing rebel who, during his 4 years as a leader of a small, impoverished nation, sought to improve the lives of ordinary people while at the same time projecting the country onto the international stage. Unfortunately, on October 15, 1987, armed men burst into the office of Captain Thomas Sankara and murdered him alongside 12 of his aides in a violent coup d'etat. In events that eerily paralleled those in the Congo 27 years earlier, when Patrice Lumumba was murdered, the attackers cut up Sankara's body and buried his remains in a hastily prepared grave.
Jonas, before we come to Sankara, Thomas Sankara, you know, just to top up that bit about Patrice Lumumba, He was captured with, by the help of Belgian partisans, you know, just his own people. As you know, he was going to state, you know, a meeting with the state authorities by the former Mobutu Sese Seko. Then he was sent to Katanga. Katanga, then again after that, he was executed. They see him as a martyr for an African movement. And that is again key, because we have leaders who are thinking Africa, thinking Africa should unite. And they are great leaders in their own right. But every moment, there they are. They have to bite the bullet. Thomas Sankara, we have just also had, great leader. He came, you know, just with the interest of his own people to make sure they had wonderful life.
Yeah.
Wonderful life. And there you have it.
Yeah, it's and I was really going to just talk a bit more about Thomas Sankara, because I think probably because A, we share borders, which used to be the upper vote of Burkina Faso, Burkina Bay. And you know, for many years, the question has always been who killed Thomas Sankara or who ordered the killing. And many few people doubt, as one person, one writer puts it, that Blaise Compaoré, who was Sankara's closest friend and confidant, has been accused of personally either murdering him or ordering the hit. And, you know, when I think I'm sure you can actually see it now in my thoughts here, Julius, because when you said we're going to discuss about betrayal, looking at it from the African context, I was wrestling with this, because I was thinking, okay, betrayal on one hand and what actually happened on the other hand. Can betrayal be seen as good or bad, or does it depend on the motives? And if I may, Julius, if we talk about betrayal, in essence, betrayal has been in existence since the beginning of mankind. And as one writer puts it, what's his name? I've forgotten his name. It will come to me. Clausewitz, who was a Parisian army general, I think in the 18th century, and he said, you know, everything is to do with politics. When it comes to war, is the political will that will inform or make the decision. Betrayal has always been in existence, and it's no different to being betrayed by your friend or it being a political movement. I think when it comes to politics, I think this is where the emotions take over and sometimes turns into something nasty. And as of late, I've been listening to Machiavelli. I've been listening to The Prince. And, you know, people who listen to Machiavelli will know where he stands. And according to Machiavelli, for him, the moral code of humanism and religious belief considers betrayal as being wrong. Machiavelli argues that people, particularly political leaders, should have flexible moral codes so that they can bend them when they're necessary. To him, whether actions are moral, bad or good, is irrelevant. But in all, it's all about gaining power. So it's worth to note that Machiavelli was not a Christian. So whether, you know, it's against your religious beliefs, to him it doesn't matter, as long as it gets you to attain whatever you want to attain, to reach your objective, that's all it matters. So if you look at that, and you bring it in the context of politics, then you can see how people are easily influenced to make decisions that will forever affect you and I and our brothers and sisters back home and people in the diaspora. Is betrayal a good thing? I think in the African context, it is not. It has never been a good thing, and it will never be a good thing. But as a political, looking at it from a political dispensation, is it a good thing? I think some might argue, depending on where you stand. Because to them, they might think It is needed. So if you look at Blaise Compaoré right now with Thomas Sankara, some have argued that Compaoré actually wanted the French to still remain, be part of Burkina Faso, which were totally against, contrary to what Sankara believed, because Sankara wanted complete disassociation with foreign entity. So on one hand, you can see where Sankara was going. On the other hand, you can see where Compaoré believed in. And this is where the bone of contention is. And it never ends in, you know, in anything good. One other thing, in more recent times, as you and I have discussed this so many times, Boris Johnson, Rishi Sunak, the former prime minister and the current prime minister. The current prime minister was the exchequer under the former prime minister. He supported him. He supported his bill in parliament and everything. But at one point, Rishi Sunak realized that to him, what Boris Johnson was actually doing was detrimental to the party. Boris Johnson claims that Rishi Sunak betrayed him, stabbed him in the back. So in at this juncture, would you, you know, argue that betrayal was wrong, or was it good? Was it bad or good? But let's not also forget Boris Johnson.
It meant him. It meant Boris stopped dancing.
let's also forget that Boris Johnson, with the infamous Chuck Checkers, also betrayed Theresa May. So betrayal has always been part and parcel of politics. And sometimes the end result of a betrayal is bloody, is deadly, is disgusting. It destroys progress. One gets money, gets
rewards,
you know,
benefits.
Motivated, rewards, benefits. On the other hand, one loses their life. In African context, it has been consistently one case after the other. If you look at the leaders post-colonial era, it's just been constant tool that has been used by the West, or that's embroiled within politics itself. So whether it's good or bad, I think it depends where you stand. Me personally, I think it's bad on all levels. But if you want to enter into the terrain of politics, then be prepared.
But in the context of Africa, John, it's really, really horrible. Because you see, you're talking about a continent with leaders who wants for proper independence and of the country and the people of Africa. That's what you want to see. This is a former colonized continent. So the country is up there. And you know the history of all this, how it started. And again, it has been that attachment of the West to Africa because of what Africa has to offer. And that what Africa has to offer, all the minerals, the wealth, it should be protected by good leadership. But the West has never given Africa the chance to see these leaders nurture, stand, make the continent totally independent of the West, and also benefit from what Africa has. So it's a serious concern. It's easy to say, I mean, I don't care. Let Sunak betray Boris as many times as he wants. Both of them, their betrayal has no immediate consequence to the ordinary folks in the UK, because even if they have to wrestle for leadership, it doesn't matter who will come out. A leader will come out somehow. But we are not talking about all the British resources are gone.
Our
lives being controlled by like a unseen foreign power somewhere.
Yes. I made that comparison, or made that example simply just to explain that, you know, betrayal in one sense, in when it happens in one country, can be seen as, you know, non-violent, just people, just different ideas. But in other countries, can be detrimental, can lead to all kinds of things, people losing their lives and the stagnation and the progress of a country.
Listeners, we're going for a quick break. Don't go away.
Colorful radio.
Welcome back, our listeners. And before we went for break, yeah, we covered a huge ground there. But what we want to do now, away from Thomas Sankara, we have seen lately, not long ago, another betrayal. But for who? Colonel Gaddafi, as he advocated for Africa, unity of Africa once again, suggesting African currency again. And of course, we saw the rest is history. He was also, you know, chased, caught by his own people, and of course, he was killed, murdered. But away from Gaddafi, I wanted to bring this to like modern times where we check different ways of Africa being betrayed. Look, African countries became independent. Africa is awash with resources, wealth. But this wealth, riches, they don't benefit the Africans. Africa is so rich, but yet so poor. And when you look into what has caused all these problems, we don't even need to go back so far away. After the independence of African countries, after the coups, some of them sponsored by the West, regime changes like the case of Libya and others, all this happening. After all these things are happening, we also have the most important area where the West exerts is pressure on Africa. And this is the economy. Many African countries, the economies of African countries have been at the mercy of the Bretton Woods institutions. We're talking about the World Bank, IMF, the National Monetary Fund, and these have, in a different way, you could say, the new colonial masters. Yeah, there are colonial masters, but these are neo-colonial masters because, yeah, if you remember not long ago, Jonas, we saw IMF, it even had the guards and came to the point, World Bank at the same time, giving African countries loans. And these loans came with preconditions. So these preconditions economically, you're talking about SAPs, structural and adjustment programs that crippled economies of African countries. And actually, that is the bottom of it. So today, we have seen emergency of African countries looking east, dealing with China. China didn't speak democracy that much. They are like, give us the, let's have the deal. Let's do the roads, right? Okay, we don't know what that means in democracy. We just want to do the roads and you pay us. And the African countries have gone running to China, but now China is no longer in the picture. Still, IMF, the World Bank are still chasing Africa. So, Jonas, do you remember some time when the campaign to cancel the Africa debt came from London?
Yes, I did.
And you imagine that campaign coming from a place like London, led by a famous UK musician. But when you look into that, cancel Africa debt, because even Western countries have seen the damage this debt by World Bank and IMF has done to African countries. Now, Jonas, when I was doing a documentary known as The Wrongs in Africa Today, at that particular time when some leaders were hesitant to commit to the loans, I was informed whenever African leaders said no to the loans, IMF, World Bank, the same institutions will come up with a different product, disguised as different, but actually it's the same, and sell it to the Africans, and the Africans would buy. Now, that dilemma, that challenge, that deep hole that IMF loans have sunk the continent was time not meaning anything because of the role of China in the African economies. But now we have the emergency of IMF loans, World Bank loans, Kenyans are so upset, some of them, of course, extremely upset, because the president has been getting loans from the IMF and the World Bank. Let's hear what one of the activists, very well-known activist, Okiya Omtatah, this guy has always taken the government to court from his own pocket, and he's not even a lawyer, and he has won so many cases for Kenyans. And he does it from his own pocket. So let us, wow. You know, he just, like, not long ago, the finance bill, controversial finance bill that sent Kenyans weeks in protest on the street, kicking tear gas, fighting with the police. That bill finally was struck by the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
Let's hear what he's going to say about the latest development about that.
Okay. The cost of living is a direct consequence of political policy, and it underscores the primacy of political action over market forces. What we are really suffering right now is that the political actors right now are not prioritizing or taking action to prioritize the questions around the cost of living, which are influenced by fuel, the cost of fuel, and the cost of production generally has gone up. So it really needs political action, but the president has declined to take the political action that is required. And as a consequence of that, the cost of living continues skyrocketing. But as you know, anybody will tell you there are only four things in the world that a government needs to address seriously. The first thing is food. You must keep food away from the control of the ordinary fluctuations of prices on world markets, on the open markets. Number two, you must control the cost of health. Number three, you must control the cost of education. And number four, you must control the cost of transport. And if you look at our government, all those sectors, it has done nothing to intervene. So if the government was to intervene and make those sectors no-go areas for cartels and the do-no-gooders and the thieves, this country would not be going through the mess it is going through. Somebody will be very comfortable living on the street and sleeping on the rough on the street, but having food in his stomach and being able to be treated when he's sick. It doesn't require a house over food. It doesn't require shelter over health. It doesn't require shelter over education. And it needs to move around. So our government has literally failed to address the key areas, and there are four. Health, food, health, education, and transport. Those four areas have failed. These are the four areas that burden the citizen most. So you need a government that can take political action to address those issues and see how it can cushion the ordinary person from the vagrancies of those commodities, or the effects of those commodities on their lives. But when I look at it, I don't see it in President William Ruto, especially now that he has surrendered his mind to the mind of the IMF and the World Bank. IMF and the World Bank have just one purpose, to create client states. And if you look at the policies that have been rolled out by the Kenya Kwanza government, they are largely designed to make Kenya a client state, to put Kenya on its knees so that you can keep on depending, moving around with a beggar's ball. Production in Kenya has become too expensive. So everything is going to shrink, the economy is going to collapse, and you shall begin begging all over the world. And we shall be a perfect client state for the West. So William Ruto, I think, is empty. His head is empty in terms of what are the existential threats that face the black people, that face Africans. He swallowed the issues of the white man, the way they are packaged. He doesn't understand crony capitalism, how it works. So he has now become an agent of the West to destroy an African state. And some of the things he's doing are bordering on treason. That treasonable, and maybe going down the line, he might be impeached if he doesn't change course and begin understanding what Article 1 says, that the people of Kenya are sovereign. And when they elected him, there was nowhere in his manifesto where he said that the IMF and the World Bank are going to govern Kenya when he gets into office. He promised to govern this country, but he's destroying it. Everything is crumbling in 1 year. It's not acceptable. So he needs to shape up, or he might get impeached down the line.
This is Colorful Radio. Colorful
Radio. Dennis, I hope you caught up with the strong sentiments from this fearless young man.
Yes. Wow. There's so many things we said there, and many things to unpack here, Julius. But before I come on to it, I just wanted to say, I know that, you know, we spoke about the previous leaders in the post-colonial era, and one just thinks, my goodness, what they could have achieved if they were around now. Can you imagine these leaders being around now with their technological advancement and everything, and their vision? Gosh.
About the eradication across Africa.
Yes. Yes, and also what seems to be, because the last, you know, just as we moved on to this, you talked about Libya and Gaddafi, and one thing just, you know, just sunk in my head, you know, which I'm sure we've you know, many people know, is that the common threat, and what you see here, the pattern, is the unification of Africa. But that's the biggest threat to the West. That's the biggest threat. Now, coming on to this, Julius, is interesting. And, you know, upon everything that the activists said there, you know, I agree. And how many Kenyans are seeing President William Ruto as not being able to live up to the expectations of what he promised Kenyans. He spoke about four fundamental things that, for him, are essential. And these are not luxury, but necessities: food, health, education, and transport. And also he spoke about the market, the opening of the market. And he talked about, you know, the Washington Consensus, IMF, World Bank, and so on and so forth, the Bretton Woods system. And it strikes me, because I think it's either our leaders do not or have forgotten of the history of, you know, successive countries. William Ruto is, I can bet that he is aware of what has happened. He's been in government and he knows what has happened. He's an experienced politician. He knows what happens. But for some reason, Julius, it just begs his belief that what their previous leaders faced is the same thing our current leaders are facing, and how they cannot break the barrier, how they cannot break out of this system, is just mind-boggling. History is there. You're a politician, a street politician, a citizen. You know your country's history. You know the fight, the struggle. You know all these things are there. And then when you get into power to make an impact, to make a difference, you also fall by the same sword. I just don't understand. Now, the activists spoke about the open market, and also you also talked about the Structural Adjustment Program, SAP. And this has been the policy that always crumbles African economies. And this is why Africa is chained to the feet of its former colonial masters or the Western powers. These open markets, this is how it works, Julius. And this is how the Washington Consensus, the World Bank and IMF come in. If you want to be part of the global market, the condition that is required of you as a nation is to open your market. You open your market, and what happens? Influx goods come into your market, which in effect has an impact on the local produce, manufacturing, and that kills businesses because your market has been flooded. This is what killed Nigeria's economy back in the late 70s, 80s because of IMF conditions. And it's not as if our leaders are not aware of this. They are aware. They know. So what is it? That is my question right now, because this man articulated this beautifully. So how can you still be begging the IMF? And you know for what will happen to the country. It's either the leaders do not have the country's best interest at heart, that they're out for themselves and just out to please the Western donors. And unfortunately, if we allow this to continue, then I'm sorry to say, but there's no, you know, the future looks gloom for Africans. we know on one hand the restrictions have been put in place, but knowing one thing and not doing anything, and not knowing and not doing anything are totally complete different things. We know. So what can be done? What Ruto became, his videos went viral. His clips went viral. President Ruto, his clips went viral. We need to stop using the dollar. I'm quite sure that he actually gave one clip I saw. He made a statement and instructed Kenyans that if you have any dollars, you best spend it, because Kenyans are going to do away with the dollar. Where did that policy go?
I remember watching an American journalist taking the mickey of him, and actually at the same time this journalist was also afraid, because he was like, did you hear the Kenyan president talk about the dollar? And then he kept on asking, I have never known that sometime we can take economic advice from a Kenyan president. But could he be knowing something we don't?
But then,
because even after that, mm-hmm. is when he made this speech in South Africa, making so many Africans very happy that we need to end the use of dollar. We need our own currency in Africa.
So then the question is, Julius, if you compare, because I think it would be good for us to more or less compare the leaders of today to that of previous generations, especially the ones we've spoken about today. Because to my understanding, the post-colonial leaders did not fear death. And come what may, they were pushing forward with their ideas and ideals and what they knew was good for their nation. The leaders of today does not give me this. I don't get the same feeling when they want to get into power and they say things. Look, let's use Ghana's president, for instance. I remember in his conversation when they had a press conference, Julius, with the French president, Emmanuel Macron. And he's saying that Ghana beyond aid, that we cannot be dependent on the West. Now, people are asking, where is it? Ghana beyond aid. What happened? Ghana just borrowed a huge sum of money from the IMF. So I'm asking myself, we have all these policies, are they just soothsayers? They say what everybody thinks. For us to believe that these are true leaders, these are the ones that will take us to the promised land. We're not seeing it.
What is it? But lately, Jonas, we've seen the Malawian president, Lazarus Chakwera, leading by example. He was in the news saying that the economy of Malawi is not in good shape and is going to take measures to bring it back. And he said it by himself. He said, fine, from today, this year, as your president, I'm not going to attend any international meetings which a president should attend, and I'm also banning the attendance of any international travel to all the cabinet ministers and everyone. And in a year's time, perhaps he's going to recheck and see whether they've made savings out of that.
Julius, I don't mean to interject, but in as much as I applaud him for taking that stand, I wouldn't say for Malawi to cut themselves off the global stage or the global economy as such, right? Now, I've just mentioned the Ghana president also, Ghana beyond aid, we haven't actually seen it come to fruition. But on the other hand, what he has done, is to push forward the African Continental Free Trade Agreement, which, again, I think this is where the strength of Africa really lies, the unity. I think the political unity has been overcome. So you have the regional bodies. I think it's the economic unity. I think this is where the issue is. And in as much as sometimes, you know, listeners might think I'm contradicting myself. I am not contradicting myself, because I think sometimes a lot of us are just infused with what's going on. We want to see things happen, you know, more rapidly than they are. But also it would be unsincere of me not to talk about other policies that they're trying to implement to try and, you know, solve some of the issues that we're currently facing. So one policy which I think we have to commend the African Union for, I know we've had our negative issues or whatever it is they say we don't agree with, but this particular policy, the African Continental Free Trade Agreement, is a policy that, if it's able to be implemented, I think they're waiting for a few countries to ratify this agreement, that would definitely unite Africa economically. And I think possibly what it is that we're looking for, you and I, and people in the diaspora and Africans in general, is for this to be cemented and to, for us to, you know, trade with one another without using the dollar. Okay.
Exactly. I think that's very true. And as much as we applaud Malawi, no country can remain as a pariah, a nation state.
Absolutely.
As a pariah nation. But the measures are wonderful. I think it kind of sends some sense. For some time you've seen African president, he travels with his 8 wives, for example. And also almost all of them are guarded. They are those who are guarding them and entertaining them. And they travel abroad and they choose the most expensive hotel to stay. I mean, that kind of travel, it should be totally unnecessary. I mean, today what is trading in Kenya is the numbers of people President Ruto traveled with in Dubai, this COP28. So cutting costs is something that all Africans, presidents, have to find a way how to cut cost, to minimize cost. If it's travel is an issue. I mean, I saw late Magufuli, president of Tanzania.
Yes.
He came with that ideology of lessen.
Yes.
If it's travel, let the most, if it's something to do with tourism, let the tourism minister go. Not a delegation of, fans around him, just to make it feel important. And they cost the country so much.
No, hotel bill. I agree. Yes,
the travel,
I agree
100%. The entertainment, their shopping.
that I agree. I agree 100% with you, Jimmy. Yeah. You know, I'm sure we've both been to